And now, your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lernis.
Hi, everybody. Dean Haglund here in the offices of the Rational Exuberance in the heart of the historic core of downtown Los Angeles, in the middle of the Art Deco wonder that is the Eastern Columbia. It's on. You're here with your co-host.
I'm Phil Lernis. You know, and I just pronounce my name the way you pronounce it. You know, you don't have to do the big introduction anymore because we have a minute-long song, except that you love cutting it off after 8 seconds.
Yeah, well, we get to the show. We got so much show.
And we have so much show.
How much
song
and
so
can we
little to do. Well,
do.
We should, but I love the song.
I love the song, too. Don't
I have to keep hearing it when, you know, when I publish it on different sites and everything.
Yeah.
This is a brand-new installment, episode 2, year 6, your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
Yep.
Fortunately,
still can't get the audio right. Okay, go.
I need to get
some
a glass
water.
Of water.
Right.
So why don't you tell me about what may end up having to be our live event of the week, because this is the first week I failed to do a live event. I got so busy. But Dean Haglund running a marathon might actually...
Might I point out a half marathon? I am holding right here the medal that I got crossing the finish line at 13.1 miles of hard running. Hard Palo Verdes running. For those of you who don't know, Palo Verdes is on the Pacific coast. It is a lovely community in what they call a rolling course, where the elevation varies between sea level and 150 feet or 200 feet above sea level. And there's some cliffs there.
Let me see this medal.
Yeah.
Finisher? Geneva Inventors Expo. What? No, that's the wrong medal. Half finisher. You're a half finisher.
I'm a half finisher. I know, right?
Yeah.
I
think that's you supposed to be. You never follow through.
Hey, you're right. That is a sad.
It does say Palos Verdes half finisher.
Wow, that's disappointing.
Where'd you place? Were you in the top half of that half finishing?
I don't actually. I haven't ever looked at my time yet. Because it was just, you know what, it's just important crossing the finish line. It's not,
well,
not a race.
You say that, and yet I was around here, the offices of Rational Exuberance, where you and Patty were talking about the importance of getting into the top half.
Which I think we did, because we came in at 2 hours, 24
minutes. She came back into town to run this.
She came back into town
leaving,
before leaving for out to...
That can't be easy, all the plane...
She apparently had no problem with it. She got on a plane, sat 4.5 hours, Chicago, and then another flight, and then she jogged 4 hours today, 4 miles today. I, on the other hand, am limping from a torn tendon. My heel is seized up. I have muscular issues left, right, and center, and she handled like a walk in a park. So
you are not a young man.
The lies of all of this. Yeah. Okay, so I'm not a young man, but there are many people older than me running these half marathons.
You know, it would be an interesting question, and maybe you know the answer to it, but it would be interesting. I used to run track and field.
Yes.
Quite successfully. Don't kid yourself.
I'm not.
But one question would be really fascinating. When these people who run the marathons, I guess, for a living. When I was running track and field, you maintained your amateur status so that you could run in the Olympics. Now,
right.
You don't need to. But when these people who are, for lack of a better word, professional distance runners, how long before an event do they like to get to the city that's hosting the event?
Ah,
I'd be curious. You know, like how long do they need
to acclimatize, to prep,
exactly,
the whole thing?
Do they familiarize themselves with the course? How do they go about it? It would be fascinating.
I never heard them answered either. I would think it takes some time because you want to not just step off a plane and start running 26 miles. But at the same time, for as little training as I had walking into this 13.1 mile race, I thought I did very well in keeping up with the people around me.
We will probably pursue all of these inquiries further.
Yes.
On our spinoff show, All About Sports.
All About Sports. Marathon go-go.
Yeah. Now, venturing into the realm of Hollywood.
Yes.
That is part of our name, Chill Pack Hollywood hour.
And I do have a chill pack going.
You did some kind of a nutty comedy shoot this week with our friend Greg Travis, didn't
yes,
you?
I did a nutty comedy shoot.
Now, I was so busy when you were asking me about this that I never really kind of grokked what the project was.
I don't even think I've done it, and I'm not sure I grokked the project either. As far as I could tell, if you get into a driving incident in New Jersey and go on to the online school comedy traffic school thing, in between course loads, there will be various comedians doing bits about driving. And so I did like 10 minutes of bits.
What's the deal with women drivers?
Totally. Ever noticed the thing? And
why is it California automobiles are not equipped with a left turn signal?
Here's some handy tips when being abducted and driving at night. You know, that kind of thing.
By aliens?
By aliens. Yeah. Oh. Funny, right? So, so recorded some of those things.
I've not seen that freeway alert yet.
Not yet. But along such luminaries as Pablo Francisco is in there, Deborah Wilson from Mad TV. We had a long chat. A lot of big comedy names in there. And we all were in there in the little...
You know, Bobby De Niro told me never to name drop.
That's right. I forgot. I'm just saying, if you get a traffic DUI or something in New Jersey, by all means, go on the online traffic comedy school. I don't even know if that's the website.
But you know, it occurs to me we have questions from our listeners.
That we say we're going to get to every episode.
No, we haven't. We've said we were pre-recorded for 2 weeks. We've only been back 1 week. We had so much to catch up on. No, and in fact, I'm only realizing that we had these questions right now. I don't have a laptop in front of me.
Oh.
Or a frontal lobotomy. I don't know. Anyway, no, apparently I have. Staring into that solar eclipse for too long.
Yeah, good luck.
I thought I'd be safe with the pinhole glasses that you prescribed.
No.
No,
clearly, don't look at the sun.
I bring this up almost apologetically. I know that one was from John Girodo, and it involved L.Q. Jones, a boy and his dog.
Uh-huh.
And we have a couple others. But these came weeks ago when we were traveling. So we will get to them. I will make sure to look them up as soon as I'm back today, and we will put them on the agenda for next week.
Very good.
I wanted to touch briefly on a show that we did Friday. Maybe this is our live event.
There.
We did another installment of Combat Radio.
Yes, we did.
Now, you had been on either the week before or the week before that.
I called in to promote the Kickstarter campaign, which has reached its goal 3 days ahead of... 4 days ahead
four
of schedule.
4 days ahead of schedule.
Yes, and yet the people are... The pledges are still coming in.
Of course, because people can still get great swag.
Great swag, and it's no pressure on you. It's simply one of the easiest, most inexpensive ways to get a Dean Haglund original artwork into your sweaty little palms.
And we...
I don't know if that's...
Wow, that was...
My palms are sweaty.
Great sales technique. Your palms are sweaty.
My palms
are exactly sweaty. Which exactly is what I've been meaning to talk to you about.
I'm just nervous
around
you. And
I'm thankful every day that we're not doing this as a video simulcast.
Why?
Because people would see my reaction every time you reach out to hold my hand.
You're
so
dangerously...
So we were on Combat Radio.
Dangerously near me.
Our third trip, Dean Haglund, and you're dangerously near me. Our third trip to Combat Radio. So much fun. We actually... we were waved into the studio early to take over
basically
Derek Forbes' show. May the Forbes be with you.
Yes,
we thought we were on Combat Radio.
I know.
We did not realize the man on the phone was the host of the show.
Yeah,
whom quite clearly we were running roughshod over.
Roughshod over the poor guy, and I had no guy. Simple Minds had no. I just put the headphones on. I hear it a couple times, and then suddenly it dawns on me, like halfway through the interview, going, "Wait, we're on his show." And we're just blabbing on it and, you know, giving them no space whatsoever. Very rude. We were very rude Americans.
We were on a two-hour then installment subsequently of Combat Radio, special two-hour installment. I love that Ethan always makes it a two-hour installment when we're on. And I love even more that he just kind of kicks back and lets us take it.
I know.
Because
he tweets
we were
a bit.
Fascinated by the guest.
Mike Denon. Mike Denon, the physicist.
Renowned physicist who's on Ancient Aliens,
yep.
Science of Superman.
Yep.
And
professor
so,
at UC Irvine.
UC Irvine. We're going to be interviewing him along with Ethan for Truth is Out There. two and three, probably.
Right.
Both of those, I would think, and in the next coming weeks. So it was fascinating because we just kept wanting to pepper him with questions, and Ethan just let us go.
Let us go.
Much as he let us go. And in fact, Mark Ryan was so great, who, of course, is Bumblebee from the Transformers and a fascinating guy who brought a deadly weapon into the studio. Yes. He was great because he came and tagged out with me and sent me in when General Zod was on. Because I don't do the General Zod segment. I don't know what to do with that.
Is you that go what on Mark said? There. Yeah, that's hilarious.
It was great. It was great. But Mark paid me the ultimate compliment on the show, Combat Radio. Oh. When he turned to me and said, Phil, you are the weirdest guy I have ever met. That's pretty
Mark
good.
Mark Ryan said
yeah.
that?
Wow. For Mark Ryan. I mean, he's been around. He's seen things that would
curl your hair,
turn you white. And, that might be a bad example.
Yeah, that's a bad example. But yes, he's seen a lot of weird people in his day. And for you to be the weirdest does cross a line.
So it really was a lot of fun. And we'll post a link to that show on our ChillPack Hollywood site.
Right.
And all our pages.
Because at a moment there, it felt like our ChillPack Hollywood podcast.
It really did.
It did, didn't it?
It really did. I would say that out of the two-hour show, there is definitely an hour that is your ChillPack Hollywood hour.
In fact, if we need an extra show, we could just clip that one and cut it in.
But I loved the conversation with the physicist. This was it was so refreshing because this is a man who... has a very rational mind. He has a skeptical mind. He
yes.
also has just a real sense of adventure and play, and who champions the importance of imagination, and you know, not only in terms of how much breakthroughs have been inspired through imagination, but also the importance as an educational tool of getting students to imagine something's possible,
right,
and then. Okay, how would we prove it, or how would that possible thing operate within the universe given the laws of physics as we
right.
understand them?
Which is exactly how Einstein came up with the theory of relativity. He imagined himself riding a beam of light when taking the bus to the patent office in Geneva, where he worked as a lowly patent clerk, and yet coming up with breakthrough ideas in physics because of his imagination.
It strikes to me this the importance of looking at the history of science and looking at the developments of science as never truly being something where someone's theories or understandings that had been accepted, let's say, as fact, mm-hmm. are disproven by later discovery,
right.
because that's really not it. Just as I always am so resistant to phrases like supernatural or paranormal,
right.
it's that we transcend a previous understanding.
Right.
And what does it mean in science to transcend a previous understanding? Well, often it seems to me the path is that we go smaller. We recognize that it's not about the laws operating in the universe. It's that there's perhaps another universe underlying that one.
Which
and then
has
another
its own,
one smaller than that.
Has its own set of laws and physics and like quantum mechanics.
It's its own set of understanding.
Right.
Really? And a whole new set of observations that's possible once we recognize that that universe is there. And truly, we are constantly getting smaller and smaller.
Right.
In this way. But also it occurs to me that there's then the macrocosm, which is the other way to transcend our understanding is to pull back and take a larger view. For example, only recently in Western thought, which again I always try to correct to industrialize Northern thought.
Very good.
Are we starting to think of this Gaia principle of the entire planet as a living organism.
Right, as a single entity.
That kind of macrocosm, which, oh, by the way, is an ancient knowledge,
yes.
is an ancient wisdom, but again, in the industrialized North, is only a fairly recent transcendent view of our planet as we had scientifically looked at it before.
Right.
And we can do this, can we not, pulling back even farther with the whole universe, perhaps, as one organism, one being,
right?
That's operating together.
That's expanding faster and faster as the day goes on. All of these new discoveries that happen in the cosmology around us.
And so, to take this again out of science, because from my the way I walk through the world, science, much like art, much like religion, much like sports, any of it, it is all a metaphor for how we can live our lives and walk through the world. If there is not a parallel to how we walk through the world and how we engage with this thing called life, then there is a limitation to me in the value of the work that one is doing. Which is, you know, in our bailiwick in terms of film and television, and this is the problem that I always have with that conversation that we've brought up time and time again of something being quote unquote just entertainment.
Right.
I'm looking for just entertainment.
Yeah,
just
yeah.
to be distracted from my life for a while.
Yeah, exactly.
As opposed to something that maybe might remind you that that life itself is really worth living.
And informing that life.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So this concept of transcending our previous understandings of things, when it comes to something like going around the world, recording people's stories and their version of events and their version of truths, it's so important because, again, it moves beyond this idea of right and wrong. It moves to this idea of you had an experience. You don't need to prove that experience
right.
to me. Tell me of that experience because I am fascinated by the very fact that you had the experience.
Which is Tucker Smallwood's whole thing.
You know, and it's my whole thing in terms of how I approach these people because, look, you not only can you never prove to me that how something happened to you is exactly how it happened
right.
to you. In fact, I can disprove that claim really easily by asking, have you ever been in a relationship?
Yes, haven't exactly.
Haven't you been constantly told, no, that, things didn't happen the way that you thought.
Right, you are wrong.
Yeah, you're wrong. All the time. Our memory is faulty.
Yes.
Men, we're never going to be right.
Exactly.
But the importance is that the experience happened to you. And I'm intrigued about, you know, what that experience did for you, what you learned from it, how it affected you, because all of those things lead to, dare I say, truth.
Ah, and that reverberates out like a pebble in the pond, and those ripples of how that affected you and how you then work your way through the world and your journey
will affect me.
Will affect me and affect many other around.
And I'm taken beyond this idea of do I have to believe, do I not have to believe? As we discussed in Germany, you were so quick to disbelieve someone's report of something, and instead of recognizing all the telltale signs that clearly something did happen to them.
Right.
And if we could simply listen without needing to try to go, well, I don't think that's exactly what happened to them.
Right.
We might, God forbid, learn something and be moved and be inspired and changed.
Right.
So I think this is a great segue into something we wrote about in this week's blog, because so much of what we have to talk about on this week's show is about embracing the unknown.
Ah, very good.
And opening with a sense of mystery, as your friends in podcasting like to do.
We do all the time.
With a sense of wonder and a love of the mystery, we embrace the unknown. And we start with the mystery of the Lincoln Cathedral.
What?
I mentioned this last week.
Yes,
how
you did.
I had visited the Lincoln Cathedral,
yes.
Shot some footage for Truth Is Out There, Ancient
uh-huh.
Mysteries.
It said it was very mysterious.
And I promised to share the story of the Lincoln Cathedral.
Because I know nothing about it, and specifically did no research, like I do every episode.
And as you do when you do interviews, conduct interviews, which is so important,
yes,
really.
It is. Okay.
Because again, we are not people who in our documentaries are so interested in making films about information as we are, again, interested in telling stories about people, in making films about people and how they came to the information they have, how they came to this knowledge,
yeah.
What path led them there. The mystery of the Lincoln Cathedral is fascinating. There is a conspiracy theory. That surrounds the fact that the Da Vinci Code,
mm-hmm.
either intentionally or ironically, used the Lincoln Cathedral as a double for Westminster Abbey.
Oh.
When Ron Howard made the film version of the Da Vinci Code,
yeah.
they could not
film at
use
the Westminster. Yes.
Westminster Abbey.
No.
Or they never wanted to use Westminster
what?
Abbey.
What? Knowing it'd be too expensive.
And chose Lincoln Cathedral. Well, knowing it might be too expensive would be one end. But perhaps there are other reasons why they chose to shoot in Lincoln Cathedral. You see, there is a mystery written about and documented by Callum Jensen under the rather amusing pseudonym Dan Green.
No.
Not Dan Brown.
Dan Brown, Dan Green. How amusing.
And it is a mystery involving the Templars and Mary Magdalene.
Right, Knight Templars.
So what could be more appropriate to the Da Vinci Code?
That seems to be the whole story.
The bloodline of Christ, right?
Yeah.
A great place to start this mystery is the east window depiction of the Last Supper.
Oh.
On Christ's plate in that depiction.
And this is a stained glass.
I brought a little picture of it to show you. Yeah, stained glass depiction.
And do we know what year this is? Is this pre...
I'll talk about the history a little bit. Let me tell the story first.
That'd be better if we...
But on this plate, on Christ's plate, you will find, rather than a cup or a loaf, which are often traditional... There's a dog.
What? That's a dog. Holy.
What? There are two other dog symbols that I can find anyway, prominently featured at the Lincoln Cathedral. Furthermore, the dog symbology or symbolism, I don't know what, is symbology a real word?
Symbology is the course you take to learn symbolism.
Okay. Yeah. The dog symbology reappears once inside the cathedral. And once outside, reinforcing the theory that hidden symbolism and the layout of the building embraces the principles of sacred geometry and a transmission of secret architectural knowledge, hinting at the dog star Sirius.
Fantastic.
The same dog that appears on the plate of Christ in that depiction of the Last Supper appears on a 15th century woodcut of the Stations of the Cross, staring up at Jesus on his way to Calvary.
Wow. And woodcuts are in the Lincoln? Or where's that woodcut? Is that...
And it's pronounced Calvary. Is it Calvary or Cavalry?
I've heard Cavalry.
Calvary. Yeah. I'm having trouble pronouncing it.
Because it's Calvinism, like, but Calvary.
Right, Calvary, on his way to Calvary.
Yeah.
There's another dog that's staring up that accompanies the statue of the famed Holy Grail poet Lord Tennyson outside the cathedral.
Ah.
And these dogs always staring upwards.
Staring upwards.
So again, the theory is that these dogs are placed there as clues pointing to the cathedral's sacred geometry and that these architectural oddities reference the dog star Sirius.
Right.
Okay.
Which... is why we have the dog days of summer, because they thought that star heated up our atmosphere in the summertime.
Absolutely, Dean Haglund. So you didn't need to do research.
I don't have to know.
I did not know these things. You did.
Yes.
There is a magnificent rose window.
Ah, the rose line.
And an unusual sundial, both of which reference, apparently, the dog star.
Really?
In terms of the hours on the sundial that are affected, the placement of the window, and what star gets centered within the window certain times of year.
Well, yeah. Aligned to Sirius. That's pretty cool.
Much more symbolism within the cathedral that supposedly alludes to the bright morning star Sirius. Perhaps the most important element of the cathedral is its morning chapel dedicated to...
Sirius.
Mary Magdalene.
Mary Magdalene.
And boy, this chapel in a cathedral that is so breathtaking and I don't even know, the words escape me.
Right.
You know, where do you begin when you're in something that is completely, in terms of its overall and in terms of its detail, so overwhelmingly mysterious and powerful and jaw-dropping, and yet the simplicity and the humility of this Mary Magdalene morning chapel for me was the most powerful, energetic place in the entire cathedral.
Isn't that something?
According to the Da Vinci Code,
right,
the Grail was Mary Magdalene,
right?
Was she not?
She was the vessel,
and she is buried, again, according to the Da Vinci Code,
right,
underneath ancient Roslyn.
Roslyn Chapel, north of Edinburgh.
Oh, is that what it means? Well, there's a theory about the Lincoln Cathedral that it is the last resting place of Mary, the Grail, that she is buried beneath the starry skies revealed through the rose window of Lincoln. Let me replay really? This for you. The Rose Window of Lincoln.
Rosalind.
Rosalind.
Rosalind. See that?
There. See what they did with that? Everybody write it down.
Write it down. Rosalind Lincoln.
The first church, in answer to some of your earlier questions, first yeah. church was built on that site in 60 AD.
Wow. So that was a Roman...
And it was the Church of Mary Magdalene.
That's what it was in 60 AD?
Yes.
Wow. Really?
And it was destroyed in 1097.
1097, the Battle of Hastings, just after that.
So it
would have been the pagans coming from the Viking hordes north side.
So it was thought that, and the area of Lincoln does have this, it was a Roman settlement.
Right.
It does have the Viking settlement. So really, this incredible yeah. history. It is thought that the Knights Templar, the alleged guardians of the Grail, of mm-hmm. course, might be responsible for the transmission of this secret architectural knowledge contained in the cathedral.
Mm.
Viewed from the air...
Oh, yes.
Lincoln Cathedral is in the shape of the Cross of Lorraine.
Right.
The original insignia employed by the Templars.
Which is a very common way to lay out churches, by the way. So I wouldn't hold too much to that, but that was a very common... But
why is it common, though? Is it common because of the influence of the Templars, or...
Oh, yeah. Well, that's right. Or is it structurally...
Or did the Templars take that symbol because it was so common?
Right. Mm. Good question.
This brings up the great question, but before I get to that, to what you're speaking, there is one other little oddity that I love and that I shot, and to which you were compared when you called in to the midweek drive.
Really? I was compared to?
You were compared to the cheeky Lincoln imp. you may recall you were referred to as the cheeky Canadian imp.
Yeah, I didn't know what they were referring
There's
to there.
There's a resemblance, by the way, between
oh,
you
yeah,
and
look
the
at that
cheeky
imp.
Lincoln
oh my
imp.
God, the ears are identical.
A Masonic marker on the cathedral high up between two arches on the north side of the angel choir. This 13th century demon is said to have been blown into the cathedral by the wind. And traditionally, an imp is a small demon that creates havoc by spreading untrue tales and lies among the gullible.
Wow, that is my whole career. No, wait, I don't know.
It also, though, going back to this story, this conspiracy theory, the history of this church, well, this becomes the crux of the question then. What are the lies? Right. What are the untrue tales? What are the rumors being spread to distract the gullible?
Right.
Is it this whole story of Mary Magdalene and the Rose...
Da Vinci Code and the Rose
Line. The Rose Line and the Grail and Templar lore and the Dog Star Sirius? Or are the lies told to the gullible, the
Church.
More orthodox
tales? Fascinating.
And to have this symbol... These symbols on a church is extraordinary because it is almost demanding, is it not, with irreverence?
Yeah.
Think for yourself.
Right.
Come to this place of worship, this place of housed wisdom.
Right.
Where the wisdom is not simply in the sacraments that are performed and told and expressed, but in the very structure of the building itself. Come to this place of wisdom, this place of knowledge, with an open mind, asking questions, forming a relationship for yourself.
Interesting.
Which is one of the most...
Basic tenets of...
Well, I mean, but isn't it... what's the word? It's not sacrilegious, but when you people were
blasphemous?
Burned at the stake. Yeah, I mean, isn't it...
That's
it's
blasphemy.
Heretical.
Yes, heretical, sure.
You come and decide for yourself.
Yeah.
Whoa, now!
Yeah, well, that's what Luther did when he read the Bible for the first time, hence Lutherism. But... have you been to the? You haven't been to the Roslyn Chapel. Maybe we should visit that in conjunction with this, because the Roslyn Chapel has similar but also fascinating oddities going through that church as well, including a lot of Masonic imagery that was built.
Or we just already hit the point pretty good, which was about forming the relationship to, because these things are not isolated to any one.
That's right.
Church.
Yeah. It's true. Anyway. I was just trying to get up to Edinburgh again.
Well, you were supposed to be, and now you bailed on that.
That didn't happen. So, well, that's how it rolls.
Hey, we missed a lot of entertainment news while we were away.
Right. Where should we start?
Let's hit with Rupert Murdoch being declared as, and I quote, unfit to run an international corporation by the UK Parliament.
I could have told you that years ago.
I, first of all, far be it from me to defend Rupert Murdoch,
but
being fit to run an international corporation is such a low bar.
I know.
I mean, what do you mean? It's like psychopath? Check.
Check, yeah. Megalomaniac? Got it. Yeah. Crusher of unions? Done.
To be limboing under that bar, and oh, by the way, for a group of politicians to be declaring what's fit or unfit.
I know.
Especially in the world of international finance, when these people have all collectively so successfully run...
The international...
Well, nothing, really. Have they successfully run anything?
No. The groupthink in that is ridiculous. And I don't even know why you would make such a statement. It's not even up to... they're just trying to make it seem like they're doing something about the hacking scandal, where everybody's phones have been listened to, which we know here in America happens all the time. My phone is a leaky faucet that anyone can listen
to. But a private company doing it is really, to me, the thing. You know, even in the UK, I mean, look, they have CCTV. They know they're being watched all the time.
Right.
But a private corporation doing it. To me, the most disturbing thing was not that it was unexpected in any way. It was, we come out of this last 15 years of cases like Enron and the Wall Street collapse and the horrible things that are done by companies
as
a daily practice to keep the doors open, to keep the cash coming in so that they can keep the illusion of the bottom line, so that they can increase that stock price and keep going.
401k.
And yet it's a house of cards. The thing is, what came through about Rupert Murdoch's companies, these companies are in fine financial shape.
Right.
This was behavior that we were becoming very aware of, but on the part of desperate corporations.
Right.
That kind of desperation on the part of a healthy corporation, if they're doing that when there is no problem, oh my goodness, what does that mean?
When there is a problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, how far will they go?
And the other thing is, you know, Rupert Murdoch threw himself on the sword by playing the infallible defense of, I didn't know.
Right.
It's my fault because it's my company and I didn't know what was going on.
Right.
You can't prove a negative. So it's very hard to prove that he did know. And quite frankly, maybe he didn't. I mean, let's give this man the benefit of the doubt and say he didn't know.
Right.
The question is that any kind of excuse? Never mind the adage of a ship captain being responsible for the crew under his command and their reactions. Never mind the thing that drives us nuts about how corporations have been given the rights of an individual, and one of the ramifications of that is that ultimately no executives are responsible,
right?
Because the corporation is an individual. But in this case, it cannot let Rupert Murdoch off the hook, because when the company you are running is a communications company, lack of communication within that company cannot be an excuse.
Right. But let me tell you this antidote to go, because when I was working on the X-Files, everybody said, oh, well, Rupert Murdoch must be really happy with the show. It's making so much money. I go, well, here's the story of how much Rupert Murdoch knows about television. And I heard this from an executive who was at the senior boardroom meetings where Rupert sits at the head and each department of News Corp, Fox News, right, all of them, they go through their financials. They don't talk about, we've had, rating. They just, and so Fox Television, 20th Century Fox Television, gets up and goes, we have 18 shows that we're producing in-house. It costs us approximately $270 million a year to produce these shows. And from Avenue Revenue, we are making $570 million. And Rupert goes, can we make that $230 million? Yes, sir, we can. We drag a line through $270 million, and it's now $230 million. So now $50 million has to be cut. You get a phone call at the X-File production office going, everybody gets cuts, and you're now $50 million, half a million dollars less in money to make your TV show good luck with that.
Right.
And you hang up. That's how much Rupert Murdoch knew about the X-Files.
Well, okay, but that does not excuse it in any way. In fact, this is exactly my point. So if people complained, oh my God, it's inhuman what they're putting us through with these budget cuts, then Rupert Murdoch could say, oh, I had no idea. And indeed, he didn't have any idea. My point is, it's a communications company.
But he's not communicating.
Well, exactly. So there is no excuse for that. And the reason that, as we know, every single employee of Rupert Murdoch's companies, be they Fox, Fox News, whatever, are fucking miserable, right? We have so many friends that work for them. How many employees of Fox News have to be publishing anonymous blogs about how horribly miserable they are in the experience, you know, before people realize, yes, there is a culture, a corporate culture here that is killing the people that work there. And what might be the response, the reason for that? Absolute lack of communication whatsoever.
Yeah, but look at his rise to power in Australia. What he did, he had, what, two newspapers his father gave him. He subsequently fired all the unionized typesetters and reporters, took wire services and put in naked girls on page three, and then proceeded to buy every other newspaper in every major town. And then from the money that he got from the newspapers, bought up to television stations, doing the exact same thing. Then once he had that, he bought Foster's beer and came over here.
This is an interesting, you bring up actually an interesting point that dovetails with another one of these news stories that I found myself uneasy about. But here's Rupert Murdoch, who, again, yeah, it's easy to forget this. He's Australian.
He's Australian, right? Yeah.
And he has such a huge influence in the media in this country, in the media in the UK, the media around the world. And it wasn't that long ago where it was really important in this country for the media to remain independent. And owned by Americans.
Right. Remember that?
Influence, foreign influence of the media was really something to be guarded against.
Right.
For right or wrong, that was the attitude. And I just read that a Chinese company, I think it's Wanda, is in the process of buying AMC Theaters, which is our second largest theater chain.
Right.
And it made me uneasy.
Because
it should be American owned. I still had this kind of...
Wow. Well, that just shows your naivety, because I don't think AMC, you know, they have systematically, weren't they the ones in the news story that we had here, suing Bryan Cranston, of all people, in Palm Springs because he had a little independent movie theater across the street from an AMC multiplex. And they were going, do not, if you show any movies.
No, they weren't suing him. It was the other way around. He was suing a major chain.
I thought it was AMC.
Because they were putting, he was suing them, though. It wasn't the other way around.
Okay.
He was suing them because they were putting pressure on the studios saying, don't let him have good movies because his theater is getting attendance. Even though they're movies that this chain theater wouldn't show in the first place.
Right.
But those movies that Bryan Cranston's independent theater in Palm Springs were showing were doing good business.
Right.
So basically what the theater chain was doing was going to the studios and saying, hey, if you want us to show your Harry Potters, if you want us to show your Avengers, if you want us to show these, don't give your arty good movies to this theater over here.
Yeah.
Because they're outdrawing our crap studio products.
How is that not making you any uneasier than a giant communist country owning AMC?
But Bryan Cranston is suing. Bryan Cranston is able to bring this subject out because he's got notoriety. He's got visibility.
Right. So
nobody seems to be complaining, and I'm not even sure that there should be a complaint. I'm just saying I'm uneasy, and I wonder whether... or not, I'm right to be uneasy.
I think you're unright. I think you're incorrect to be uneasy.
It's
because it's already global, and they've already bought all our debt. So we go over there and thank them profusely for not letting us.
Yeah, and I don't want to risk it. I mean, you know, the Chinese love me.
They do love. You're huge in Shanghai. Don't kid yourself.
Right. I am known there by the nickname that Ethan and Combat Radio gave me on Friday.
What was that?
The cupcake. You know, speaking of the media and the television industry, did you see that a lot of these studios and everything are ganging up, really warning that the TV industry is basically doomed if Barry Diller's new Aereo Is not stopped. And of course, Barry Diller was a long time head of stock at Fox.
At Fox, yeah.
And movies. And Aereo is a way to access all television programming through the internet.
Uh-huh. Right? Like and, Hulu, sort of.
And it's a subscriber-based, and, you know, and, oh my God, the TV industry, it's going to be, it's going to basically decimate it if this is allowed to go forward. And it just occurs to me, having watched an episode, the last episode of season one of Star Trek The Next Generation on Sunday, where these people who were in cryogenic freeze made it to the 24th century, and one of them wants to watch TV, and no one knows what he's talking about.
Right.
And he finally explains what it is, and they say, oh yeah, that died out entirely in 2040. Next Generation is going to be wrong because it's going to be 2020. Right?
It does,
I mean, TV's... It's
doomed.
It's
doomed.
It's a dead man walking.
Yes.
Right. Now, this does not mean we won't have episodic entertainment. Of course not.
Absolutely. There'll be webisodes. There'll be all sorts of things.
It doesn't mean we won't be watching it on what we call our televisions, but which really are monitors.
Our monitors now that we can get access different feeds. So we can access a feed from a satellite. We can access the internet. I can do all of that right there on that.
So it's business models. It's distribution models. It doesn't, from an end-user standpoint of getting entertainment.
Absolutely. And, you know, if their model is selling advertising, I got a note for them. Because of TiVo, I don't watch commercials anymore. So if commercial advertiser companies are looking to actually communicate with me, they're going about it the wrong way if they're buying
30-second... What commercials do you watch, though?
Well, that's just it. The ones that sort of jam in on the front of little YouTube clips that I can't get past.
And the ones I watch are the ones I seek out.
Yes.
And I seek them out. Why? Because I've heard about them. And why have I heard about them? Because people have tweeted about them, or people have posted about them, or people put them on their page going, if you haven't seen this, this is hilarious.
Right.
Right? They become viral. The commercials themselves become viral as a form of entertainment.
Right.
What's wrong with that?
Make entertaining commercials.
And, you know, and this speaks to this whole idea of how social media is already changing distribution. It's changing distribution of commercials, like we just talked about. Mm-hmm. It's changing distribution of content, not just in terms of the way Barry Diller anticipates with Aereo and things like this, which, quite frankly, I think will only have a shelf life itself. It might be the final nail in the coffin for TV as the way it's been done, but it will have a short shelf life because this is going to continue to evolve so quickly. But two different stories. How about the fact that Cabin in the Woods, which you saw and enjoyed, even though it was never supposed to, it's going to get a theatrical release in Australia. And why? Because of a Twitter campaign.
Really?
Because the studio said, wow, there's enough interest in this. We're going to do this.
We're going to do this.
I championed the film Margaret that so many other critics championed, Friends of Margaret on Twitter, finally got a bit of a theatrical platformed release. And now, not 2016, this summer, it will be released on DVD and Blu-ray. And not only that, the Blu-ray will include a 3-hour and 6-minute director's cut. So we'll finally get to see Kenneth Lonergan's version of the film, which I can't wait to see because this was a film with so much greatness in it, though it was a near miss. And one of the reasons it was a near miss was you could tell there were subplots missing. So threads went nowhere.
Right.
Now, does that mean that the 3-hour and 6-minute version will
be amazing?
Solve that problem? No, but certainly I want to see if it does.
Yeah, totally.
And why is this? Social media.
Of course.
Pressure put on through social media.
Right, and this was the whole thing in the first place of who is watching what and how do you know what they want to see? This has been the guess for the longest time. You know, the secret in advertising is that no one actually knew how many commercials affected sales. You had all these algorithms, but they were guesses in a way because you didn't know why suddenly somebody was buying a product. Was it just that the commercial was successful or that everybody started talking about how great the product was? You know, these are two different things that are unknowables.
We get these questions a lot about our own films, about other films we talk about, music, whatever. You know, people asking, oh, that sounds great. How can I see it?
Right.
Where can I see it? Well, to a certain degree, how and where do you want to see it?
Exactly.
Where and how do you and your friends and the people with whom you interact want to see it? However that is, make that happen.
Yeah.
You do, to a degree, have a power to make it happen.
Right.
And that power is, oh, by the way, going to grow.
Right.
Because as audience sizes for any platform, if we can call it it, be it terrestrial television or Hulu or movie theaters or Blu-ray, mobile devices, the audience size for each platform is going to get smaller.
Right.
As more platforms proliferate.
Yeah.
Those people who seek out something on that particular platform are doing so because that's the platform they enjoy.
Right. And this is this.
And as that size grows smaller, distributors of content to those platforms will become more responsive to the desires of that audience.
And this is the thing in marketing that's new now, is that this idea of tribal, that you find your 10, 15,000 tribe and you just market to them. You're not trying to go country to country. You don't change your advertising specifically for Australia or for Germany and for Europe. What you do is you find the 10 to 15,000 people who are hardcore, and regardless of their geographic location, you communicate with them in its own branding advertising space. And from that, then you connect the product to that tribe, as it were.
And with the responsibility of having a tribe, I mean, with the power of having a tribe comes responsibility.
Yes.
Right? As we... Thank you, Spider-Man. Such might have been warned, I think, of the voters in North Carolina who, while we were gone, voted a same-sex marriage ban.
Right.
29th state in this country to ban gay marriage through popular vote.
Okay.
This one was sort of unique in a couple of respects.
Dear old North Carolina.
It went so far that it defined the only legal union as a marriage between a man and a woman.
So...
common law marriage, no longer. Same man and a woman living together for a long time, who previously might have been able to be on each other's health insurance.
Yeah.
Not anymore.
Really?
All
how about divorcing then 50% if you live together for all your life?
I don't know. But how about this? It has to be a man and a woman married,
right.
Period. 50% of the people who voted for it acknowledged later that they thought they were still allowing homosexuals to have civil union. All the legal protection of civil unions. But no, this eliminates that.
Wow, so nobody read it.
Because nobody read it.
Right.
And we've had this same experience here with Proposition 8 in California. Mm-hmm. So many people who believed that, didn't understand that homosexuals had the right to, or not just homosexuals, we all had the right to same-sex marriages.
Right.
In California, and that right was actually voted away. And so many people to this day don't realize that that was the case here in California.
Yeah.
Because they didn't read the actual proposal. And this is the thing that comes responsible. What was fascinating, though, was in the wake of this, President Obama coming out in favor of same-sex marriage rights.
Because Joe Biden said so earlier, and so it was just like it became an issue. And why not? This is, and now it's, from what I'm seeing, there's a groundswell, a lightning speed of all of this being an issue. Except I don't understand why it's an issue. At a time when we're on the, Greece is about to default, we're on the precipice of an economic meltdown, we are concerned with something as ridiculous, in my books, as gay marriage. I mean, sorry.
Well, no, here's the thing. I understand why this issue is of economic importance.
Yes.
To a section of our population.
That has health care.
Absolutely.
Right, yes.
I understand why it is of emotional interest in an even larger section of the population. People who feel strongly that they ought to be entitled to the same rights and classifications.
Absolutely.
As their fellow citizens, and it matters to all those who love them. I also understand the emotion about those who oppose it so strongly, who fear it. I understand it. That does not mean I condone it. It means I understand it.
Right.
the point to which you are speaking, which is a disturbing point, is how often an issue like this, about which there will always be such strong feelings, how this is so often used and manipulated as a distraction away from issues.
Major issues.
It seems to me our political, quote-unquote, leaders have no answers for.
Right.
So therefore, what wedge issues can we choose to debate?
Bring up, yes, at a time when we need not just political debate, we need management. We need solid economic management at this time.
Yeah. I would say to you, though, you know, even looking at it through the prism of economic management, if you want to wage a debate about same-sex marriage from an economic standpoint, there is no argument against it.
Right.
You know, the I'm not saying that you should be in favor of gay marriage. If you're not, if you have personal reasons to be opposed to it. But if you're looking at it from an economic standpoint, it would be really good for our economy, for our communities, on that, through that prism.
Through that prism.
So it is interesting. And yet that part never of the gets debate addressed. Doesn't get addressed by our political leaders.
Yeah, boy.
So much news. We even have... you know, a film director, Daniel Adams, who was sentenced to prison in Massachusetts for abusing the Massachusetts Film Tax Credits Program, running a massive fraud. I know production companies that have done this. Mm-hmm. I have witnessed this in the past. Mm-hmm. And
for someone to get caught, it's hilarious, though.
And for it to be a director...
Yeah, well, why the producer?
Rather than a company or whatever, well, maybe the director was responsible for it. And what I love about it is that I always, you know, we encounter this with filmmakers all the time. You know, it is so hard as a filmmaker to get the resources that you require to bring your vision to fruition. And the incentive, therefore, is sometimes to lie, cheat, and steal to get what you need or to get more than you need.
Right.
But in reality, if we are ever to get to the point where artists are trusted enough so that when they say, this is what we need to do the job, it will not come with all manner of strings attached, hoops to jump through, second guessing that actually renders the job more difficult.
Yeah.
If we're ever to get to that point where the artists are trusted, then the artists have to be trustworthy.
That's the thing.
So,
what better way to trust them? You know where I was at? The Beverly Hills Art Fair yesterday, speaking of live events. There's many fantastic artists, and what a direct connection between a guy, his art on a piece of grass in a tent in Beverly Hills, and you addressing and buying the art directly. There's no galleries, there's no markup fees, and it was a fantastic event. I recommend everyone go to it every year.
Sounds great. That could be your live event of the week.
Sure. That's my live event of the week.
Two-Pack Hollywood live event of the week.
We won't. We'll save what movies we've seen and what we're reading for next week.
Fantastic.
How about we do our first Two-Pack Hollywood lawsuit of the week?
The Two-Pack Hollywood lawsuit of the week.
I think in a while, right?
In a while, yeah.
And it's good news. To me, it's good news. We like being able to share occasionally a heartwarming lawsuit of the week because a lawsuit was dropped. And it's one that we've been following. The opponents of the SAG-AFTRA merger have dropped their plans for legal action. Opponents of the merger between the Screen Actors Guild and the American Federation of Television and Radio Actors have thrown in the towel and decided not to pursue further legal action against the merger. David Castleman, an attorney for the opponents, stated the group's intention to drop the case in a letter to the union's attorneys Thursday, and the main reasoning for not pursuing legal action was that in light of the overwhelming vote to approve the merger, it didn't make much sense to buck popular opinion. After careful consideration, largely reflecting on the results of the recent merger election, my clients have reached the conclusion that continued prosecution of the pending litigation would not assist the cause that they sought to champion. The letter reads.
Not assist the cause they sought to champion.
Yeah, that... Continuing prosecution of the pending litigation would not assist the cause that they sought to champion.
Which is the getting work. So therefore, they made themselves...
Yeah, what is that cause? I would like to...
know. Yeah, if the cause is for everyone to be paid fairly... And
yeah, well, I mean, I have no idea what the cause is, or is it a union of actors for actors exclusively? What is it?
Yeah,
you know, this is the thing when it comes to leadership and communication,
right? And we're talking to you, Rupert Murdoch.
And we're talking about missed opportunities.
Yes.
So often we've spoken on this show of the missed opportunity that President Bush famously embodied when he told us in the wake of 9/11 to go to war and go shopping. Al Gore, when contesting the 2000 election, it always seemed to me the huge missed opportunity here when the writing was very much on the wall of how difficult it would be to challenge a presidential election in court, that a high road was available to him that could have given Al Gore such statesman status.
Yes.
By saying, I do not think it's good for this country to carry out a contested election in courts. So therefore, I am withdrawing from this election. I am conceding this election. I would call now for a thorough examination of how votes are cast, how votes are counted, and the process through which we challenge these in the courts.
Right. And I will head that up.
Yeah. Or just I call for this. And boy, the energy, I think, on both sides that would have been galvanized towards such a thing. So, you know, you look at these for the opportunities for leadership and communication. In this letter, certainly the lawyer could have taken the time to espouse again those principles that the opponents of merger were seeking to champion.
Right.
It might be the best time now to really, and to take a leadership position, therefore, in this new union that's going forward. Because people might now be open to saying, oh, well, I'm glad that they're not fighting this in court,
right,
that they're coming back into the fold, and, those ideas make a lot of sense.
Let's bring those ideas to the table and have them in our new formed union.
And so I really, that was a little disappointing to me as a missed opportunity. Your Chilpack Hollywood lawsuit of the week. Finally, we close with...
John Travolta. No, sorry. That's a different lawsuit.
I'm trying to give pause for Garrett Watley to say two magic words, celebrity death.
Celebrity deaths.
Oh.
Donna Summer. Died Friday.
Yes.
63, I believe, after a long battle with cancer. You were probably not a fan.
Nope.
Because her career was music. That tends to rule you out.
Rule me out.
The thing about Donna Summer... And I joked about this on Combat Radio, saying, does this mean disco is dead?
Right.
Never dead. Donna Summer was one of those people whose career really unfairly took such a major hit when disco did die.
Right.
The sound of disco was so easy to copy
and
recreate that it hit this oversaturation point so quickly and invited such imitation by lesser talent that the genre did die.
Yes.
Donna Summer was a woman of such singular talent that it does not matter what era in which she had emerged or what genre she had chosen to pursue. She would have been an iconic music figure.
Transverse that, exactly. And of course, go ahead.
Well, and also in the realm of most closely identified with disco, though a career that had preceded disco by many years, Robin Gibb of the Brothers Gibb also died after a lengthy health battle.
Right.
He was 61 or 62.
62, I think. Yeah. Again, didn't listen to much of them, of the Bee Gees.
They have some incredibly crafted songs. I mean, really, and even long before the Saturday Night Fever
album. Yeah, I believe my sister had the early albums.
And, you know, there is nothing but a doff of the cap to what a major cultural touchstone that Saturday Night Fever soundtrack
absolutely
was.
Huge.
While we were away on our adventures in various parts of the world, Maurice Sendak died.
Oh, yes.
At 83.
Where the Wild Things Are.
Particularly known for Where the Wild Things Are, and more than a dozen picture books he wrote and illustrated himself.
Yeah.
Much like the Dean Haglund of his age.
That's right.
Wait till
I get to my dark childhood storytelling phase. That's going to thrill us all.
In addition to Where the Wild Things... What phase have you been in? In addition to Where the Wild Things Are, which was published by Harper and Row in 1963, other titles he wrote and illustrated from the same publisher, In the Night Kitchen.
Ah, yes.
Outside Over There, which together with Where the Wild Things Are, all form a trilogy.
Ah.
The Sign on Rosie's Door, 1960. One of my favorites, Higgledy Piggledy Pop.
Oh, yes.
1967. The Nutshell Library. And a box set of four tiny volumes comprising Alligators All Around, Chicken Soup with Rice, One Was Johnny, and Pierre. What better way to end your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour than remembering Maurice Sendak?
Yes.
You can find every installment.
Every one of them.
Well, someday you'll be able to find every installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour at chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, Hollywood.com. Download them, stream them, subscribe via iTunes.
Even review it on iTunes.
We may have to revisit Stitcher. We may want to get on Stitcher as well.
Yeah, okay.
You can...
like us on Facebook.
Like us on Facebook.
Facebook.com/chillpackhollywood.
Read a blog each and every week previewing the coming week's show at MySpace, myspace.com/chillpackhollywood.
We're still there.
Follow Dean Haglund on Twitter.
I'm at D. Haglund.
I'm at Phil Larenas. And write us, chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. We promise next week we'll be getting to our backed up
backlog.
Bag of letters.
Fantastic.
Till then, I'm Phil Larenas.
Dean Haglund.
Belated spoiler alert.